Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 15, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The U.S. accuses Hamas of using hospitals to conceal and support military operations.
We do have information that Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad uses some hospitals in the Gaza Strip as a way to conceal and support their military operations.
Tens of thousands of Jewish Americans marched for Israel in Washington, D.C. A peace activist is looking for a lasting outcome to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. 500,000 people in Somalia are driven from their homes by floods. Labor unions in Nigeria embark on another nationwide strike. Vote counting in Liberia's runoff election begins today, Wednesday.
The commission informs the two contesting parties and observers that the tallying of votes will begin tomorrow, 15 November 2023, across the country. Preliminary results will be read at the daily press briefings.
And at least 4 million people die of diabetes every year globally. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United States is backing Israel's claims that Hamas, a U.S.-designated terror group, is using hospitals in Gaza for cover to direct its military operations and hold hostages. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden has more.
Israel's no longer alone in accusing Hamas and its allies of hiding behind hospitals in Gaza.
We do have information that Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad uses some hospitals in the Gaza Strip, including the Al-Shifa Hospital, as a way to conceal and support their military operations and hold hostages.
Pentagon spokesperson Sabrina Singh echoing comments from the White House, saying the two groups also operate a command and control node under Al-Shifa.
They have weapons stored there and are prepared to respond to an Israeli military operation against the facility.
Both the Pentagon and the White House say the newly declassified intelligence was collected by the U.S., though they refuse to say how. The U.S. intelligence comes just a day after the Israel Defense Forces issued a video showing what it says is under Gaza's Rantisi Hospital.
A hideout where terrorists take hostages and hide out.
At the Israeli embassy in Washington, Deputy Chief of Mission Eliav Benjamin tells VOA.
We are releasing as much as we can.
Benjamin says there is evidence innocent civilians are trying to leave and that Israel will give them as much time as it can. But
at the end of the day, Israel will take action against these terrorists.
The Pentagon's Sabrina Singh says the U.S. is still urging caution.
Absolutely. We do not want to see a firefight in a hospital where there are innocent civilians.
Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
Tens of thousands of Jewish Americans rallied on Tuesday in Washington in support of Israel to call for the release of the hostages kidnapped by Hamas and to reject anti-Semitism. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias covered the march for Israel and gathered many of the diverse points of view that were expressed.
Under the watchful eye of several law enforcement agencies, thousands of Jewish Americans gathered Tuesday at the National Mall in Washington to express support for Israel and call for the release of the hostages kidnapped by the militant group Hamas during a terrorist incursion into Israel on October 7.
Just like you have, Israel made a corridor so that Gazan refugees who wanted to leave, who were in fear of their lives, they made a safe passage for them. I'd like to see a safe passage for the 240 kidnapped Israelis that were taken from their homes.
Everybody saw what Hamas did. And of course, I pray for, you know, to minimize civilian casualties.
Rally-goers also denounced all forms of anti-Semitism.
I have never experienced so much anti-Semitism in my life. I'm used to anti-Semitism, but not at this level.
There were also calls for the United States to ramp up its support to Israel.
I think that more financial aid is needed. I think that making sure that the Middle East stays safe is a huge priority for the United States.
Among the thousands of people who gathered for the March for Israel, there was a subgroup of people who had a different set of views concerning the conflict in the Middle East.
They participated under the banner of the Peace Bloc and were led by lobbying groups such as J Street and the NGO Americans for Peace Now.
Some questioned aspects of Israel's military offensive in Gaza.
I wouldn't consider it a counter-demonstration. I would consider it a piece of the larger conversation. What we need immediately is we need a pause in the fighting. We need a humanitarian pause.
We condemn Hamas's actions. However, we believe that to fight war crimes with more war crimes does not solve the problem.
Others share their views on what should happen when the fighting ends.
I'm in favor of a two-state solution. I think that's the only solution.
We care about Israel deeply, and we care about the Palestinians, and we want to see both of those people with dignity, sovereignty, freedom.
Despite the wide variety of opinions among Jewish Americans who participated in the March for Israel, and a couple of tense moments during encounters with Jewish Orthodox protesters on the sidelines of the main event, the rally was held and concluded in an environment of peace. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
President Joe Biden has said that Israeli-Palestinian conflict cannot go back to the status quo that existed before Hamas's brutal surprise attack on October 7 and Israel's devastating response in Gaza. After decades of trying to manage the conflict, the U.S. is confronting the limits of what it can do to affect the outcome, not only about the war, but what comes after it. Ori Ner is a spokesperson for Americans for Peace Now, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shinawi what the U.S. could do after the conflict ends.
First, I'll say I think you've put your finger on something that is really interesting, because the Biden administration, when it came in, signaled very clearly, I mean, it was very obvious that it had deprioritized finding a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Modus operandi was exactly the status quo. In other words, keeping the status quo so that there's no deterioration toward a situation where a two-state solution would not be possible anymore. And what is happening now is that they're changing their posture toward becoming more proactive in trying to advance a solution or find a solution. So to your question, what could it do now? First of all, there are many things that the U.S. can do in order to pave the way toward the two-state solution. It starts with the obvious, which is demanding that Israel stop settlement construction and settlement activity. It goes through the issue of stopping attempts by Israel to take over Area C of the West Bank and in practice annexing it, which is Israel has been doing. And perhaps doing things that would strengthen the Palestinian Authority as a nucleus, a political nucleus for a future Palestinian state, which is what it was envisioned as being from the very beginning. So there's a lot that the U.S. can do on that level. Now, when it comes to things that are more proactive toward actually bringing the parties to negotiations, I think that's where the problem is going to be. In other words, negotiations at the moment, particularly with the current Israeli government, are not possible. This is not a government that will go into two-state negotiations with the Palestinians. And I think that once there's a change, and I think there will be change, not that far away from now, in the near future, in Israel, in terms of the makeup of the coalition and the government, then you can also start talking about preparing for negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians on a two-state solution.
Israeli public opinion polls indicate that over 70% of Israelis want Prime Minister Netanyahu to leave office after the war. Could that produce the kind of coalition you talked about that would be amenable to negotiate a final resolution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict?
Exactly. Yes, that's what I'm talking about. The reason why Israelis want to see Netanyahu go is not because of his position on the two-state solution. It's important to make that clear. The reason why they want to see him go is because they think that his policies have contributed to the disastrous, catastrophic events of October 7th. They hold him responsible. They want to see him go. And by the way, this is not only the opposition to Netanyahu, the political opposition, but even within Likud supporters of his own political party.
That was Ori Ner, spokesperson for Americans for Peace Now, speaking with VOA's senior analyst Mohammed El-Shinawi. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 15. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Vote counting in Tuesday's Liberia presidential runoff election is expected to begin today, Wednesday, as Denise Nipson reports from Monrovia. The poll was marred by a low turnout in several parts of the country.
Many Liberians were surprised at the low turnout, but some said voting was peaceful and went smoothly. They compared it to the first round on October 10, when many struggled to cast their ballots because of the huge turnout. The voting process, which started at 8 a.m., ended by 6 p.m. in line with the election guidelines. National Elections Commission, also known as NEC chairperson Devieta Brown-Lansana, told the nation that some party agents were making unacceptable demands.
Some party agents were demanding the polling staff to read out the names of voters prior to voting so that the voter is identified in the final registration roll, FRR, in possession of political party agents. The commission clarified that this is against the polling and counting procedures, and it had the propensity to expose voters to undue scrutiny by unauthorized persons, thereby jeopardizing the protection of voters. Such action also compromises the secrecy of the voting process.
Brown-Lansana announced that the counting process will begin today, Wednesday, to be followed by preliminary results.
The commission remains committed to ensuring that all votes count just as they were cast. In the meantime, the commission informs the two contesting parties and observers that the tallying of votes will begin tomorrow, 15 November 2023, across the country. Preliminary results will be read at the daily press briefings.
Oscar Blow, the head of the Election Coordinating Committee, also gave the group's preliminary report and commended the elections body.
The availability of election materials and the logistic arrangements were improved as compared to the first round of voting, and the process has been peaceful despite a few minor incidents.
Former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan, who is also head of the West African Elders Forum, admonished Liberian youth to maintain the peace.
The Liberian youth, that this country belongs to them, cannot fight. They should think about how the economy of this country will improve so that they will have opportunities to work.
About 2.4 million people registered nationwide, but only 1,949,155 voted in the first round. Some Liberians are wondering whether yesterday's low turnout may even be lower and ask if that could affect the result. For VOA's Daybreak Africa, I'm Denise Nipsey in Monrovia, Liberia.
The Nigeria Labour Congress, the Trade Union Congress, and their affiliates began another nationwide strike on Tuesday despite a court restraining order. There have been strikes this year over the federal government's suspension of fuel subsidy and unions' demand for a new minimum wage for civil servants. Benson Ukpa is the head of information and public affairs at the Nigeria Labour Congress. He tells me that the latest strike action is about an assault on Labour Congress President Joe Ajaero while leading a protest in Imo State against the non-payment of salaries and pensions.
This strike is a spillover from many unresolved issues, including Imo and other outstanding issues, non-payment of salaries, pensions of workers in Imo in excess of 20, 30-something months, declaration of some workers as ghost workers, even as they continue to go to office. And of course, we are aware of the abduction and torture of the president of the Congress by the Nigerian police force. I mean, for doing nothing other than the fact that since government of Imo State was not ready to abide by the agreements it voluntarily entered into, the next line of action available to workers was a peaceful protest. In fact, that protest hadn't even started when they pounced on him, blindfolded him, beat him up, tortured him, that led to both physical and non-physical injuries on him. Yeah, beyond this, you're also aware that we had made demands on the government as a result of his ill-advised subsidy removal policy and the massive devaluation of the currency, all of which have combined to visit to the citizenry mindless social violence. So it is a combination of these that compelled us to take this action.
I will return to some of the issues you raised, but you are going on strike when the courts have said that you should not be on strike.
Well, let me tell you something. Our right to strike is guaranteed by the law, and the court ought to recognize that fact. That's one. And you know one thing? Each time we are on the verge of a strike action, the government uses the courts to frustrate that, and yet will not address the fundamental issues. And let me just explain to you. A restraining order cannot be equated with a perpetual injunction. A restraining order is a brief window for the parties to quickly, resolve some contentious issues. But when that now becomes a weapon, of course, we will ignore it.
So back to your president, Mr. Ajaero, you mentioned how he was mistreated in Imo State. But the suggestion was the protest he was calling for was intended to influence or to scuttle the re-election bid of the governor there. What do you say to that?
You know something, Mr. Botti, a tiny elite that acquires power through the back door is always unsure of itself, and we read a thousand meanings to his own shadow. It is paranoid and has homicidal instincts. I mean, these issues have been pending since 2021, and we exhausted all processes, all opportunities to have them peacefully resolved. These matters even went to court, and the state asked for a window, and the court granted this. And when we reminded the state this matter has been overdue, the state put in writing to say that they have been very busy to attend to these issues. I mean, these workers, pensioners who have been without pay for so long, so they should die because an election that is not even an election was about to take place. That guy didn't even win that election in the first place.
Bensing Upah is the head of information and public affairs at the Nigeria Labour Congress. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. The World Food Programme reports 500,000 people in Somalia have been driven from their homes to seek safety from floods that are devastating the country and pushing some 4.3 million people into crisis-level hunger. WFP says it is planning to deliver cash transfers to 200,000 people to help them survive this disaster. Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Somalia is a tragic poster child for climate change. The country is still recovering from the longest drought in its recorded history, which pushed the country to the brink of famine. Having barely averted that catastrophe, Somalia now must contend with floods that reportedly have killed more than 30 people, caused widespread destruction of infrastructure, and forced 500,000 people to seek safety on higher ground. World Food Programme spokesperson in Somalia, Patrick Wilton, says that number is increasing rapidly. Speaking from Nairobi, Kenya, he says he just came from a week in Beletwene on the Shabella River, which is flooded.
Even before the floods came, you could see the human impact of this crisis. I passed dozens, hundreds of people on the roads fleeing from low ground, donkey carts, trucks, piled high with furniture, families perched on top. I've seen camps, internally displaced people, totally abandoned to rising flood water and waist-deep mud.
Wilton warns the climate shocks from drought to floods will prolong the hunger crisis in Somalia. He says 4.3 million people, a quarter of the population, will be facing crisis-level hunger by the end of the year. Moreover, he says a million children face acute malnutrition. He says it is difficult to predict the number of people who might die from this disaster. However, he notes 43,000 people were estimated to have died because of the drought last year.
The reason that's relevant is because many of those people were in crisis level hunger, IPC3. That's not the most extreme level of hunger, but what it tells us is that if you are stuck in crisis level hunger for long enough, you are still at risk of death. So that is very much what is at stake here.
Wilton says WFP was able to mitigate some of these impacts before the floods hit. He says the agency, working with the government, activated an anticipatory action plan to deliver cash transfers and warning messages to families about where the rains would be heaviest. The plan gave families advance information so they could protect themselves from the floods. It also gave them money to buy food at a time when their cupboards were bare. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The World Health Organization says 1 in 10 adults worldwide have diabetes. Maureen Ojiambo has more on World Diabetes Day today.
World Diabetes Day is observed on November 14th each year to raise awareness about prevention and management of the illness. Today, there are at least 500 million people living with diabetes worldwide, and the number is projected to hit 700 million by the year 2045. Diabetes comes in two types. Type 1 is an autoimmune illness that may be genetic and becomes active early in life. Type 2 is more common form, developed over time, and can be caused by obesity and lack of exercise. Evans Onyango, a 38-year-old man from Kenya, was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in 2020, a chronic condition that is an insulin-dependent. He says that as an athlete, it was extremely hard for him to accept the results.
The worst part of it, I was told that it is type 1. I told them, no, I cannot be type 1. Type 1 is for the teenagers and backwards. Yeah, I experience a lot of challenges with the management because I have to take the insulin twice in a day, and it has timings. If I don't meet the times, I get worked up. Another challenge, which is a big one, is being told that I will have to live with taking the insulin the rest of my life.
Over 4 million people die every year from diabetes globally. This year, the campaign is focusing on having access to diabetes care for everyone. Onyango says apart from the medication he is taking to manage his condition, exercise has been of help as well. But he says the change of the diet and lifestyle can be difficult to adjust.
I understand there is no medication for diabetes, but I know that exercise is one of the remedies of keeping away diabetes.
The WHO is highlighting the need for equitable access to essential care for people with diabetes and tuberculosis. Speaking virtually yesterday, Tuesday, Bente Mikkelsen, WHO's director in the Department of Non-Communicable Diseases, said there is inequality when it comes to diabetes management.
So there is hope. There is a lot of opportunities. It's inequities, but still this is what we are trying to address. Patients with type 1 diabetes will actually die if they don't get insulin. But I want to emphasize that all diabetes is treatable.
Diabetes have a higher risk of hypertension and prone to high cholesterol, a risk factor of cardiovascular diseases. Mikkelsen says diabetes type 2 is the most prevalent, affecting many people across the world.
It's very important that we celebrate the World Diabetes Day. And what is especially very concerning is that if you look at non-communicable diseases in total, diabetes is the only one that is still on the rise when it comes to killing people before the age of 70.
In Africa, premature deaths from diabetes stands at 58%, higher than the global average rate of 48%. The WHO says only 1 in 2 people living with the type 1 diabetes, the most common form of pediatric diabetes, has access to insulin treatment. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in San Francisco.
that's it for this Wednesday, November 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing that you will have a lovely day.